נפתח בקרוב, שנגיע אל הסוף. יא, תעשו זאת עם שלי.
Wow, the incomparable Daniel Zamir. He is just, every time I hear him, he just blows me away. I've never seen him in person, but why? Just, the records are just incredible. That's called Hatikva, I hope, from Alive Chai. And let's see. There's a Porch Fest going to be taking place on Saturday, June 3rd, from 12 to 5 p.m. here in New Medford. It's the first ever Porch Fest in WMFO's hometown of Medford. Porches, driveways, and yards around the city. The rain date is Sunday, June 4th, and homes and businesses around Medford will host live music performances from 12 noon to 5 p.m. free of charge and open to all. How fun. With a wide variety of acts spanning genres and neighborhoods, Porch Fest will bring the talent of our diverse city out into the open air, while inviting neighbors out to meet, celebrate, and bring our city a little bit closer together. Artists and hosts may sign up through May 21st. Okay, well, that's passed. So you can't do that. Yep, no. All right, that's a message from the Medford Porch Fest Organizing Committee and WMFO in Medford Tufts Community Radio. How fun. Okay. So, as I said, we are getting ready to celebrate Shavuos, and I'm going to share with you some things from Timeless Patterns in Time, Hasidic insights into the cycle of the Jewish year, adapted from the works of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem M. Schneerson, Shlita. What happened at Sinai? Relating to God on His terms. In our prayers, we describe Shavuos as the season of the giving of our Torah. Our sages teach, however, that Avraham fulfilled the entire Torah before it was given, that he communicated it to his descendants, and that even throughout their servitude in Egypt, the Jews studied the Torah. If so, what is meant by the giving of the Torah? This question can be resolved by reference to our sages' statement that a person who observes a mitzvah, a commandment, because he is commanded to do so, is greater than one who observes it without having been so commanded. Intellect is the most refined of all our potentials, and yet the finite mind of mortal man cannot leap across the chasm to God's infinity, for no thought can grasp him at all. There need not be, however, a separation between them. By giving man the Torah and its mitzvos, God has built a bridge that enables man to establish a bond with his Maker on his terms. The word mitzvah and the word tzavta, meaning together, share the same root. When a person fulfills a divine command because he has been commanded to do so, the act which he performs is godly and connects him to God in all his infinity. If he performs the same deed without having been commanded to do so, his act, however worthy, remains merely a good deed. It does not establish a connection of the same nature. Before the Torah was given, the patriarchs were able to perceive its spiritual truth through prophetic vision. Realizing the inherent value of a life governed by these truths, they structured their lives accordingly and observed even the minutest details of Torah law. However, since the Torah had not yet been given by God and they had not been commanded to accept it, their observance did not lead to the same spiritual bond which is affected by the Jews' observance of the commandments after the giving of the Torah. This is the first time I've seen this put out so clearly. It's wonderful. Lasting results. Not only in the spiritual realms, but in the material world too. A deed performed as a mitzvah and a deed performed without the obligation of a mitzvah produce different effects. For example, The Zohar states that when Yaakov laid out the staves of poplar, almond, and chestnut trees before Laban's flocks, his actions evoked the same spiritual energies as are drawn down to this world through our performance of the mitzvah of tefillin. After the spiritual service associated with these staves was completed, however, they remained ordinary pieces of wood. The spiritual influences they evoked left no lasting effects upon them. In contrast, when a Jew puts on tefillin, the tefillin becomes sacred objects. Their holiness affects their very physical being. What is the reason for this difference? Since Yaakov's deed was not an obligatory mitzvah, it lacked the infinite power that flows from God's essence. For this reason, the influence of his actions remained on the spiritual plane and did not affect the physical nature of the staves. The mitzvos we perform, by contrast, connect us to God in an infinite bond. They are therefore able to infuse spirituality even into the material substance of this world. This difference is reflected in our sage's midrashic comment. All the mitzvos which the patriarchs fulfilled before you were vaporous, where to us may be applied the phrase, your name is like flowing oil. The mitzvos fulfilled by the patriarchs were ethereal, whereas the mitzvos we fulfill manifest a tangible outpouring of the divine presence into our material world, joining the physical and the spiritual. I think I'll take a break here, and we'll share a little bit of that in a minute. It's a lot to take in, but it's so beautifully put. All right, so let's go now to...
Oh, its own. Give night soul. I am Raha Vianos, Vianos. I am there, so.
La 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 Hallo, meine Liebe.
Wow, that's what you call a cantorial voice. Oh my goodness. This is cantor Yitzhak Meir Hafgott, and he was singing La'olam Yehei Adam. And that's a Kasavitsky composition, and what pipes. Unbelievable. Just amazing. All right, you're listening to WMFO Medford, The Voicemobile. I'm your host, Joyce the Voice. Before that, we heard Rabbi Davis Weissenberg and Erica Kerman, I think that's his granddaughter, Barry Shapiro on the piano for Shir Hamaloth, something that we sing all the time on Shabbos and on Yom Tov before we say the blessing after the meal. And we listened to Leib Glantz from this Lyle Shemurim CD, Bizet Israel Mizraim. And I wanted to continue reading from Timeless Patterns in Time, from the works of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, on the holiday of Shavuos. So joining the physical and the spiritual, can it be done? The above contrast is mirrored in another teaching of the Midrash. David said, "The Holy One, blessed be He, decreed, the heavens are the heavens of God, and the earth He gave to men. Nevertheless, when He desired to give the Torah, He nullified that original decree and said, 'The lower realms shall ascend to the higher realms, and the higher realms shall descend to the lower, and I shall take the initiative.' As it is written, 'And God descended on Mount Sinai, and to Moshe He said, ascend to God.' In other words, according to the original pattern of creation, the material and the spiritual were confined to separate realms of existence, to discrete planes that never converge. The ultimate divine intent, however, was to fuse the two, so that the underlying godliness would surface within our material world. Because God's essence is truly unlimited, this is possible. The spiritual can descend and become manifest within our world, and our worldly experience can be elevated beyond material concerns and become an expression of spiritual truth, no longer in the heavens. This fusion cannot be accomplished through human enterprise alone. It is possible only because, as God says, I shall take the initiative. This is what is unique about the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. The divine revelations before Sinai had not been intended to resolve the fundamental conflict between the spiritual and the material. The revelation at Sinai, by contrast, was intended to permeate the totality of existence. And this it did. No bird chirped, no fowl took flight. The entire natural order came to a standstill. Moreover, His voice did not have an echo. Instead of rebounding, God's voice permeated the material substance of the world from that moment onward. The Torah is not in the heavens, but rather part and parcel of the environment in which we live, so that the world itself should see. This was, however, merely the beginning of a process. The ultimate purpose of eliminating the gap between spirituality and material existence was the second phase, and Moshe ascended to God. That is, that man should elevate himself and the material environment in which he lives. As long as the connection between man, the world, and God is dependent on God alone, the fusion between these elements is incomplete. If godliness permeates the world only as a result of a revelation from above, the world remains, at least from its own earthbound perspective, separate from God. This may be understood by comparing the world to a student who is able to arrive at a concept only when nurtured by his teacher's explanations. Only when he has reached the point at which he can conceive of the idea on his own can we say that his thought processes have fully matured. The service of God epitomized in the phrase, "And Moshe ascended to God," demonstrates just such a process of maturation within man and within the world at large. Man's divine service refines the world and transforms it into a vessel for godliness, enabling the world and its inhabitants to perceive godliness not as an externally applied factor, but rather as the truth of its own existence. The consummation of our efforts to refine the world will come in the era of the redemption, when we will merit the fulfillment of the prophecy, and all flesh will together see that the mouth of God has spoken. Not that the revelation from above will be so intense as to reach down to our material realm, but that material flesh will have an independent appreciation of godliness. That era is fast approaching. All the spiritual tasks God has demanded of the Jewish people have been completed. All that is necessary now is for each of us to open his eyes, and then we will behold the ultimate purpose of the giving of the Torah, the manifestation of God's presence throughout the world. May this take place speedily in our days. So beautifully put. So this is from Timeless Patterns in Time, Hasidic Insights into the Cycle of the Jewish Year, adapted from the works of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem M. Schneerson Shlita. All right.
נתן לנו סוד תורה נתן לנו סוד תורה על יד משה מאירה שבגילה אורה וחברה
Na 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 na
בעל כנפיים, קידשו שמיים, אור הבנן בכל אתרל. הרחיב העמיק שעליו אמביר יעקב נורא.
Thank you. ותעזרני שמחה, ותעזרני שמחה. הפכת מספדי למחולי, יללן 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 ותעזרני שמחה.
שיש וקשמיר אתה ו...
Oh, that was really lovely. Yeah, that's the Tofilo Trio. And let's put that on. Okay. So, Tofilo Trio, Aromimcha, and it's on Sephard Records. We listened to Yitzhak Meir Chafkat before that. So, I want to share a little bit from Reb Shlomo Kalmach, the Kol Chevra. This is from the 18th Yortzeit, and it's called Coca-Cola versus Holy Chutzpah. It's by Avraham Moskowitz. Shlomo would say that if a thing had little value, it's the easiest thing to get it known throughout the world. Look at Coca-Cola, he would say, colored sugar water, and it's known as far as China and throughout the world. But try to get the world out on something holy, and the obstacles are too great, as I remember the quote. One Motzei Shabbos, Shlomo had a concert at Gan Sacher here in Jerusalem. Many acts entertained the crowd, estimated at over 7,000. An Israeli singing and dancing group was entertaining the crowd before Shlomo was scheduled to perform, and we were standing to the side of the stage. I asked Shlomo, "How do you know what to say?" He answered, "I pray that Hashem puts the right words in my mouth." Shlomo would ask the question, "If you see a great student of the Torah walk down the street, why do people spurn him as if he were a leper? Yet another great student of the Torah walks down the street and everyone greets him and wants to be his friend. What is the difference?" Good question. Shlomo would answer that the first wise Torah scholar is learning for himself. The second Torah scholar is learning for all of Klal Yisrael, for all the people of Israel. This is what smells so sweet. The world is filled with people seeking self-aggrandizement. Whatever anybody does, there seems to be an obsession to push it into the public eye. This is recognized by anyone who views the media, advertising political campaigns, pride in deviant behavior. This is nothing new. Our rabbis observed and spoke of this since before the giving of the Torah. Maybe it's just because we live in this era, but does it not seem to be growing more rampant? Our rabbis wrote about how to confront and offset this brazenness in the world. The answer to this onslaught is not to be quiet and humble. The antidote is holy chutzpah. Shlomo exemplified it and taught it in the stories he told us. What differentiates holy chutzpah from the bold, outlandish chutzpah we face each day in the world? In holy chutzpah, the Jew stands as a representative of God, and he or she deeply cares for and is in tune with his or her fellow Jews. It isn't so simple to represent God. You have to check yourself out more than an airplane pilot checks the controls before takeoff. People's lives hang in the balance. With holy chutzpah, the spiritual life of the speaker and the listeners are at stake. Does this sound too ominous a task for any of our chevra? There is this saying in Jerusalem, if you know an aleph, then teach aleph. That's the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. If you know something and sincerely want to share it because it will raise someone who is listening, then go right ahead. Often a person holds an internal debate. Should I speak or remain silent? What I have observed of members of our chevra is that when someone does speak, it usually really hits the mark, which then provides a consciousness that was lacking. To battle the world of brazenness, Shlomo created the tools in his songs and precisely chosen stories to adopt and utilize. Remember his famous line, "If you are going to tell the same Torahs as your Zadie and Bubby, who needs you?" It seems that he meant make it fresh, alive, vibrant, relevant. Make it yours and share it. If Hashem put us here on this earth, then this must be our time. The thing is, not how much you believe in God, but how much you know that God believes in you. So beautiful. Just another little thing I want to share. This is a time, let's see if it's going to come out or not. Yeah, this is from Israel 21st Century, the cheese that sparked a protest movement. When we celebrate Shavuot, we explore the humble cottage cheese, an Israeli staple that encompasses no less than the country's heritage, struggles, and dreams all at once. And this is by Nama Barak. I cannot stand cottage cheese. I was sure I was the only one in the country. But in the course of writing this article, I found the only other person not to like it. For in Israel, cottage cheese, or just cottage as it is known here, rules. It is home. It is childhood. It is our past, present, and future dreams. And it is absolutely everywhere. In honor of the Jewish holiday of Shavuot, which is celebrated this Thursday and marked by eating copious amounts of dairy delights, hello there, delicious cheesecake, we set out to get the lowdown on the most Israeli cheese of all. The history of cottage cheese in Israel is very extensive and is related to many social, economic, and political issues, explains Michal Levitt, a big cottage cheese lover who is the public programs and library manager of Asif, a culinary institute, an NGO dedicated to cultivating Israel's food culture. It is one of my favorite things in the world, and I learned how to eat it from my big sister. I have a slice of bread with thin pieces of avocado with salt and lemon, and then cottage cheese on top of that, she excitedly tells Israel 21st Century. It has been an inseparable part of the food culture in Israel, and the food culture in the kibbutzim, where every dining room tray was laden with the fresh cow's milk cheese, she said, referring to Gevina Levana, white cheese. So its popularity has a lot to do with the fact that Israelis have loved fresh cheese. Oops, where did it go? It just jumped. From the very beginning of Israeliness. So the cottage cheese with all its lumps only made Aliyah years after Israel's establishment in 1962, a gamble that paid off, according to Tnuva, the Israeli dairy giant responsible for introducing Israelis to cottage cheese. One of the firm's managers spent a few months in the early 60s in the United States, where he happened to taste cottage cheese. He worked his way through all the cottage cheeses he could find there and then brought up the idea at a company management meeting. So they'd never seen anything like it. They were willing to let him try. Anyway, it became a great hit, and there's more. So Israel 21st Century, and we're going to go out with some music by Neshama from her Journey CD. Here on the voicemail, hopefully you, if you are observing the holiday, you will receive the Torah in your own special way, maybe staying up all night and learning, maybe not, and hope to see you back here right next week. And then Chris is here in the station, so he'll be taking over the controls pretty soon. All right. All right, so that CD is obviously not happy. Let's listen to Yosefa from the desert. This is Taj Mahal.
Thank you.